Hello, this is Poland Podcast. I'm here in Copenhagen. I'm in this amazing, I don't know whether it's a restaurant or studio or theater. I do not know. I'm with the Alchemist founder, chef, Remus Monk. And Remus, I'm so happy I'm sitting here after visiting you, having your great food, great experience in last December. I thought we must have you at my podcast. Remus, I mean, there are people who don't know about you. Can you give a brief about yourself?
Yeah, I'm Rasmus Monk, and I have the restaurant Alchemist here in Copenhagen, which is what we call a holistic dining experience. We're also a little bit in doubt ourselves: is a restaurant, or is it? Can you say it's art, or like it's at least an experience with a lot of different artistic fields involved in the restaurant experience. But mainly the character or main character of the evening is of course the food. But I use, what can I say, my craft to have this medium of expressing myself with things I think is important in society, or things that inspire me from different food cultures, and in that way provide the experience to the guest in the evening. So it's a restaurant with more rooms and an experience that can take up to 7 hours to enjoy. Some stay here for shorter and some actually for longer as well. So it's a whole evening concept. Yeah.
I am a foodie. I'm from Hong Kong. We are all foodies. But I would have never imagined a restaurant like this. So your idea of a restaurant is to touch all senses, right? Because it's not just about food, it's about how you look, how you feel, and what ticks you. But yeah. I remember when I saw you in December, when we were talking, you said that you didn't even know about art. You were from a very remote place in a farm. And you only started to know about art in your 20s. But how could you create these things? You conceptualize everything. Tell me about your experience, your growing up, and...
Yeah, I'm grown up in a very humble place. On the farmer site in Jutland. So my family is without any cultural background whatsoever, not in food, not in music, not in art or theater. I never visit any kind of museums or theaters before I got older, and so I've never been exposed for any of that. What was very important for my father was cars, and like we had different cars and more material things, and the house that we lived in needed to be a good house and stuff like that, and the garden, but there was never anything the content in that, like what was in the frame, it didn't really matter. So I think I got literally without anything like oversaturation, like I got maybe 5 different dishes when I was a kid, and those 5 dishes, all of them included the boiled potatoes or rice. So it was quite limited what I was exposed for. I never had fish before I started as an apprentice as a chef.
What?
Really? So every Friday I visited to McDonald's where I was allowed to get the Happy Meal until I was 13, and then I was allowed to get a Big Mac. So it's really have been very limited. And then one of my best friends, he went to the culinary school. I went with him because I loved to be together with him, and we was drilling in cars in our spare times, and I thought I should be a mechanic. And then
a mechanic to a chef.
Yeah. So I went on the school, and I saw, you know, a whole fish. I'd never seen thyme before, like the herb, and there was many things where I was like, okay, this is quite crazy, and I didn't have any dream of being a good chef. I didn't know anything about Michelin stars, restaurants or whatsoever, but I came home to my mother, and I was like, felt a lack of something that was so essential as food. I was like, but there is all of this. Do you know about these things? And I never question marked it like before. So I've never questioned like what kind of things we were served in the evening. But I started doing that at the time. And I could just see there was so much I've missed out on. And something that's so essential as food and food culture. I was like, okay, I need, it probably will not hurt anybody if I go to the school and get learn how to cook as well. So it was never with a dream about having my own restaurant or being a good chef. I thought if you become a chef, you become a chef, and that's everybody is kind of the same. And of course, I learned a lot more to enter this world. So I was very privileged that I chose, and very lucky that the stars was aligned, because I choose the first and the best opportunity of being an apprentice in a restaurant, in a restaurant, in a canteen, actually,
which in a was canteen.
Yeah, so it was my mother and stepfather was living on a hill, and down in that, like when you drive down on the hill and you came, there was two houses that literally, how small the little is, not even the city, but the city before city, I don't know what you call it in English, but
village.
Yeah, it was that. There was three houses, and when you drive down the hill, the first house nearby was taken over by a guy from Copenhagen that just moved to this this little place here, and he started the canteen, like a catering company, so he delivered food to two canteens. And I went down there knocking on the door and asked if I could be a chef apprentice there. And he was like, "Would you peel these, I think it was 60 kilos of vegetables every day for 3 months. If you come and help me with doing that, we can look at it." And I did that. It was easy, like, you know, a task to do, and then just to stand and doing it.
What did your father say? Not being a mechanic and being a chef.
Yeah, I think I think they were okay. They were okay. Most in our family and people we know is mechanics, like, so either a biker in a biker gang or mechanics. And so I think they were okay as long as I got an education. So if they think it was okay, I was privileged to get an apprentice job there because he was from Copenhagen. He had been a head chef in some very good restaurants here, so he knew about. And he was one pointing me in the right directions and start talking about it was more than just food, like Michelin stars and stuff like that. But it was still a canteen. It was for 300 people every day, the blacksmiths from a little little city. So it was like, you know, good solid food, but everything was made properly, and my fundamental cooking skills
improved
like and became as what I use today in many of many things as well. Like the fundamental was very good, but it was still a canteen. So when I came to the culinary schools, like a year later, when I saw it, I get another like aha moment, because then suddenly all of these restaurants came with students that was plating food on plates. I never plated on a plate. I was also always in buffets, you know. So suddenly to see that exposed me for this feeling again of a lack of something. So I went to my apprentice place and I was like, I've not learned to do this. How can I learn to do this? And he were very much, but you're so slow to cook. You're so slow of make. You can only prepare a salad by in 8 hours. Like, you don't question anything. You don't put any like success criteria for yourself or like any ambition for yourself. And after that, I took that very serious, what he said. And I started the day after to time myself. And suddenly I made all of the food for these two canteens. I started using all of question everything. I started to look around and every opportunity I could, I got to work on other restaurants. I would do that in my spare time. So suddenly building up a lot of ego of learning, and I had never done that in my life before, so it also kickstarted a spark in me that wanted to always learn more. And I think that's it really did. Yeah.
And so you went to school, and how long is the course?
This take nearly 4 years. Yeah.
So after the course, then you went to work with different restaurant, or during the time you already jumped to working with different restaurant.
Yeah, I like the normal practice in the restaurant industry is to go on and train under a famous chef,
yeah,
and
exactly.
Train for 10, 15 years, and yeah, then you go out, yeah, open your own, yeah, thing. And I wanted to go and work for Thomas Keller in the States. I was a big fan. I have respect for food, is respect for life, tattooed on my arm, which is a quotation from him. And but the problem was I couldn't speak a word English. I had not learned any English at all.
What age were you then?
18, 19. 18? Yeah. So I filled out a form about getting a green card for the States and went to the embassy here in Copenhagen, and I got declined 3 times, because every time I was for the interview, the lady in front of me, there was asking me all of these questions. I didn't understand what she was saying. I couldn't get any help from my parents because they didn't speak English either. So it was quite challenging. And at that part, UK was still part of Europe. London was a city that was easy to go to. You didn't need any green card. So I decided to move to London. Worked for, there was a Danish chef that had a restaurant called North Road at St. John Street, just near St. John's restaurant.
In
Farringdon. And so they were writing on Facebook, we're looking for Danish chefs to come to London. I wrote to him, and there was only two criteria: that you need to have worked in a Michelin restaurant and you need to speak English. And I was like, yeah, I can do both. And I've never worked in a Michelin restaurant before, and I couldn't speak a word English. I only worked in the canteen. So that was, I remember flying over there with Ryanair and was in YouTube, like how to fillet a turbot Michelin way, because I could see they have turbot on the menu. And I never filleted a turbot before, only other fish. And I eventually found out that it was exactly the same way to fillet a fish in a Michelin restaurant and in a canteen. And was there for nearly 2 years, learned the language.
You were working there and speaking in English. You didn't go to school?
No, I didn't.
Because you have all the colleagues, they're all speaking in English.
All was in English.
I was forced to speak.
And in the start, it was quite easy because you had one trial day, and as in many kitchens, you don't really say anything, especially not the first day. You just say, yes, chef, and I could do that. Yeah. So it was quite easy, yes, chef, and do what is to show me to do. So I got the job, and learned the language. So of course, it was small things in English, but my English was quite limited at that time.
Wow, 2 years and then you're fluent.
I will not say fluent, and I'll still not say I'm fluent
you're
in English,
fluent.
But I learned the way around and things in the kitchen, what was it called, and all of the equipment and all of these things, ingredients as well. And that was an amazing place to be in UK because the ingredient was amazing. There was amazing cheeses from Neil's Yard. There was a lot of Scottish alive ingredients coming in from razor clams to scallops and it was the first time I ever seen a live scallop and abalone, because these things you cannot get in Denmark. It's very, very hard to get. So that wise, it was very amazing, and I came back from London. And
why did you come back to London? You didn't want to stay in London.
The restaurant needed to close. Unfortunately, the owner wanted to close the restaurant, and the head chef left, and I stood with the responsibility in the end. And I was like, I'm not ready to operate. I think as a head chef, maybe, and I was nearly as head chef there. I was the assistant head chef in the end, but I was also tired, and it was a very classical English cuisine, so very, very demanding. I was there from 8 in the morning to 2 at the night, 6 days a week. It was very, very tough. So I think it was okay for me to have this time now. Now I'm going back to Denmark. But it was also amazing. I love London and I love bigger cities, and Copenhagen is probably the smallest big city that I could live in, because it's still big. But what surprised me when I came to London as well was this multicultural society. I've never seen, I've never talked English with anybody before. So I've always in my city, in the farmer side in Jutland, it's like everybody speaks Danish, everybody knows each other. I also knew the parents of the parents. Like it's a very local community. And then come to London and the shops is not closed 9 o'clock. Like you can go in and get a kebab at 2 in the night. It was crazy and it was amazing. So it cultivated me a lot, both as a professional, but also as a person. And then back to Denmark, and I had this, what can you say, struggle with myself. Should I be a head, should I be in a chef or sous chef under a very famous chef for maybe 10 years, 15 years? And then I look at my age, I was still relatively young, 21 years old. And I was like, yeah, but then you need to, in 15 years, when you're 35 or something, you need to go out maybe and start your own thing. At that point, I was like, maybe I will lose, I would be lost for energy at that point. So I was like, let me start my, let me be head chef somewhere myself and try to see if I can build up my own name and find my own direction. And then I became a head chef in a restaurant called Tree Top in Jutland for 2 years, a hotel restaurant, which was fine dining.
You you become a head chef when you're 20, in your 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
My God.
So it was also, what could I say, way too early, probably, and also a very echo of other things happening in the restaurant industry. So it was inspired. I could see how do you, like when I looked at the famous restaurants in Copenhagen, I could see, okay, if you do this and this and this, you can, you are up to beat and you are modern as well. So it just ended up also being a lie, or like not that original. So I took myself in, like after 2 years of being head chef there, talking with journalists and journalists, and say that my mom was an amazing chef, and I have been all my life wanted to be a chef because that was what everybody else was saying, and I found my inspiration in being in the forest, and I'm grown up in the forest. I don't find any inspiration in the forest besides that I love nature, It was just so I have a charity that called Wish Christmas, which directly translated was doing Christmas Eve for families in need. I started that after I came home from London, because I had my Christmas Eve where it was for a similar project in London, and when I came back I was like, okay, maybe we can do this in Denmark as well. And when I did this this Christmas Eve back in 2014, I started the organization in 2011, but when I did in 2014, when I was a head chef in this other fine dining restaurant, I was like, this gives me so much more. It resonated with me so much more than actually cooking 100 hours a week for something that's not that original. But I still love the fine dining element of creating things and be innovative and try to do your own things. So I quit my job as a head chef there, and then with the idea, a couple of months later came with the idea and ambition of creating a restaurant like Alchemist.
So, and Alchemist, you only open in 2019, right? So when did you actually, so you start that, and then after that?
After that, I had Alchemist in a small version. I opened
in 2015.
Yeah, 2015. 2015.
When you say small version, it's not the 22,000 square meters.
Not at all. Not at all.
How big was that then?
It was 100 square meters. No.
100 square meters
in total, with everything, kitchen, basement, everything. So we probably went from the smallest restaurant in Copenhagen to the biggest one. It was crazy when you opened your small one.
What sort of dish were you cooking? Was it like what you're offering now?
Yeah, like slightly, it was probably a little bit more punk. It was more like me just come with an idea and let's put it on the menu, and not that much research into it. I didn't have a staff of 100 people and like equipment for millions. Like it was a smaller setting. There was 15 seats. We were five employees on our max. So we were four to start with, and it was 45 dishes. So it was a long menu, like a lot of small things. And you were sitting only one place. You were sitting in a bar, as well inspired by New York and like Japan.
Yeah,
so
like Japan,
so that kind of the counter seating. And it was for me also to find my own way. And I remember called up a journalist on the night that we opened, and he was like, but what is it you're doing? Because it was very different from Noma and like Geranium and all of the other restaurants that was here in Copenhagen. And it was not that new Nordic. So he was like, what is it? Is it molecular gastronomy, like El Bulli and Fat Dog? And with a lack of knowing how to explain what I was doing, I was it's probably molecular gastronomy. But it was something different because I attached the stories to it. I used it more as a medium. And one dish that was, convinced me that this is possible to do and this is possible, and also made me comfortable in doing it, was like an organ donation dish where you had a lamb heart in front of you. You need to scrape out this heart, the tar made of the lamb heart, and it was poured like a blood sauce on top from a transfusion back in, and it signed up. You gave a folder and you could sign up to be an organ donor at the same time. So we signed up 1,500 donors in the restaurant. And we suddenly got attention from all of the local news, but also BBC worldwide made a story about the dish. And I was like, if this little restaurant with five people employed here, we're not in any restaurant list, we don't have any Michelin stars or anything, if we can do this through our medium, then for me, that was what I felt was very interesting. So when I get my financial partner Lars involved in the project here, and we agreed on a or building a bigger place, and we closed the other one out. One of the things for criteria for me was that I had a couple of months to actually, of course, making all of the place, and that will also be longer than 2 months, but I wanted a couple of months to put down on paper what were we actually doing and what is the ambition for this place, and that became the more holistic cuisine.
So it was gradually evolving.
Yeah.
But your partner, your financier, I mean, saw you, and you tell him that, okay, I want a restaurant of, let's say, not even 15,000 square meter. He trusts you. Yeah, I mean, it's really amazing if you think about
it.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
I mean, they say, okay, 20,000 square meters, 22,000 square. How many seats?
Yeah.
Right.
Only 50 seats.
Yeah,
here,
exactly.
So it's a very small restaurant.
I mean, small restaurant, 50 seats, numbers. I mean, does your partner expect that? Hey, you know, you have 22,000 square meters. You have to make so much for us, or else you cannot turn around.
I think he's not in it for creating a new. He's an old banker, and I think it's not for creating a new bank. Definitely, so he's a big foodie as well, and a very philanthropist in a way to create projects like this. I think and for his reason is to give it back to Copenhagen. He's seen the last 20 years. We had like restaurants like Noma and Geranium, but if we need something in the future, we also need to invest in that. And it's not happening from society to do it, because food is not on the same level as institutions like theaters and museums and so on. So that backing has been amazing for me, for the restaurant, and hopefully also for the city in the future, because it's generated a lot of gastro tourism here and to the city. So I see it as a very big gift that he's done for many people, and not just for himself. And financially, he know that investment is very hard to get a return on, because as you say, 50 guests here at night, and even though it's expensive or it costs a lot of money to dine here, we use most of them on
it just costs a lot,
new machines,
yeah,
and like
110
people that's working here and so on. So it also costs a lot of money to operate this place. So,
you're from a village, but when do you learn about art, culture, music? I mean, you do, you know, performance art, your AI. How did you create this space?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think it's coming step by step as well. As when we opened the restaurant in 2019, or like start building it in 2017 to 2019, I hired a dramaturg that was learning me all the theoretic about like a theater and how that's operating and elements that you use, and was very inspired by that. And the year after, I hired an industrial designer to help us with plates and understand more about design and so on. And my good friend Bo Bjergo, which has a gallery in the Meatpacket District, which now just moved to Frederiksberg, like he was the one kind of like showing me different artists as well, exposed me for people from Jonathan Mese to Pierre Kirkeby to people that's very good at the craft and doing art, which is amazing. So, and today I'm not a big connoisseur in art. I'm not like, I have a lot of art at home, and I'm willing into it, but I'm very eager on learning new things, especially also with AI and new technologies. How can we, and with things that fit in where I feel like this resonate with me, how can we integrate that into the experience? I'm a big believer in things. I'm very, probably very naive in that way, that I think I can change the world through a restaurant, but I have the kind of same naive belief that I can do everything is possible. And I think that and when you have such a strong belief on that I have, then you're not afraid of putting 100 people every day on doing something that maybe many people will say, this is ridiculous, or this is very naive, and you will never succeed, and then sometimes it doesn't, but when you, when some of the things do, then it's also, what can you say, empower that emotion and feeling.
But you have imagination. I remember when you walked in, You said knowledge is limited, but you have vast imagination. Even with your vast imagination, you create a vision, but you need people, you need confidence to execute it. And you need people who believe in you. And you have two things. You have confidence and you have people believing in you. How did it all happen?
But also surround me with better people than myself in different fields. I know my limitations, as I said, with a public school background and
you're directing the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. But also get very inspired by others and I think like that's the amazing team, like with working with such a big team as well and so much diversity in it. When my industrial designer showed me this new metal that's like connecting when you heat it up, and then we suddenly design a cutlery that's going together when you get it in your hands and eat, and then it's impossible to take it. Like these elements inspire me to do things. And when my scriptwriter is coming with a quote from Albert Einstein about to our new room that imagination is more important than knowledge. Like so these things is, what can you say, resonate with me, or and I take it in, and then I maybe come back with some other things or add on to it, but it's a way. So that's also the hard part of this journey. I think like sometimes I'm cultivating in it. Meanwhile, we're driving. I try to find a direction as well. And I think I'm very uncultivated in many ways. So it's, I think it's a gift in many ways to explore things and just dive into it, but also sometimes I feel like it's a limitation, because I think like if I knew a lot more about this or this or this, maybe there would come something out of it. So there's a lot of things that like suddenly get me very inspired because it's the first time I see it. Or
you know, I never heard a restaurant who employs industrial designer. Industrial designer, graphic designer, and all these videography. I think you're the only one.
I think we're probably the only restaurant in the world that's so diverse in the teams and have them full time here. Like that's the thing. We have VFX artists, graphic designers, sound engineers, dancers,
and performance artists.
Yeah, and I think when you all of them have them in the same house and you want to create like a dish, or like you want to have this. We're working on a dish right now when you try to grab the food, the dish will move away. Like so, the plate will move away. Like when you have a concept about that and you want to do it, and you can just call your engineers like, oh, let's try to do that. And your industrial designer can make a frame out of it, and you can 3D print your things yourself in house. Like, so it's also from idea to creating it. It's a smaller journey than probably many other restaurants in the world. So it also make it a very creative environment to be in.
You come here, you have 50 experiences. So we don't talk about 50 dishes, we talk about 50 experience. Because you are talking about senses. So your eyes, your fragrance, your taste. So what makes you feel that senses are so important? Because you are a chef.
Yeah.
Chef is supposed to just taste.
Yeah.
But you're talking about senses as a whole.
I think the experience, what you feel when you see things, like when you see a painting, or when you see a dish, or you interact with it, or like that feelings that it creates emotions, and I think emotions is the most important. So I'm also saying to the chefs and to our front of house, we're not selling food, we're selling stories, we're selling experiences. That's what Alchemist is about. So
I remember when I came here, I ate a tongue.
Yeah.
tongue. I mean, your imagination. I mean, you have a piece coming up with a tongue.
Your tongue kissed with the silicone tongue. Yeah, exactly.
And then you look at it. It was the tongue you're eating. I mean, all that is so surreal. I know, you know, surrealism now is very hot.
Yeah.
But eating all your dishes is surreal.
Yeah. No, thank you.
You create all these impressions, but there was one dish you was just licking onto the. I could not remember, but I mean, but it's completely out crazy.
Thank you.
I mean, you have an imagination. You create a dish, and all your team, which help you to actually make it into an object. make it into something that you taste.
Yeah.
So actually is you're creating something that you see, you smell, and you taste.
Yeah, and some of the dishes is, yeah, I think there's a lot of layers into it, and some of the dishes is more than just the food itself. Yeah. It's like a story or something that happening in society or where I think it's important to talk about. But also dishes can be just a smell. It can also be just a texture. Also a travel or some inspiration from there. We have an example on a dish we just made the other week, which is this machine I bought some years ago, which is like kind of a sous vide. Many people know the sous vide.
Yeah, I know sous vide.
But this one is the opposite. So this is like freezing instead. So it's going to go down to minus 55 Celsius and use it in different lab around the world. And we have not really found a way to do it yet. But my belief was to make the perfect ice cream. I love ice cream.
Me too. And I love ice cream.
And could you, like, the texture is coming out of an ice cream machine when it's freshly spinned. That texture is the most amazing.
The smooth texture.
Yeah, and then you not a soft ice, but when you make a classic vanilla ice cream example on these Italian ice machines, when it comes directly out, it's the best. Like, the texture is amazing, but then chefs put it in boxes and you need to serve it in the evening. And you like, but could this water bath that is freezing, could that keep it on exactly the same temperature? And then you gave it directly to the guest, so it isn't lost, and it had this magical feeling. And that was the pitch to the chefs, to say, create me the best ice cream, you have the recipe on, and then we take it from there, and we try to use this temperature, and you try different varieties of temperatures and find out what is the best temperature to serve it in. And then we get feedback twice a week on the dishes and the plates and the music and the content and so on.
See, you're doing music and the content, and but you never have a background for it. It's just pure interest.
Yeah. Yeah, I think also, like, we have the treaty department now, which has been here since 2019, and we scaled it up, like, we hired more people to it, and in the start I didn't know anything about that, but beside I've seen a lot of Disney movies and I've seen different things and exposed for different things. So I had a imagination of like how I thought it would look. So it was more to translate that to the guys doing it at and say, this is how I want it to look. And to now where for now we had the department for some years, I'm very interested in. So I know exactly what programs that they're using now. How do you build up a universe like this? What kind of materials do you use? How long time does it take to render the different things? Like, I can see rendering mistakes everywhere now is a problem. But like this, so I really put myself into it and find out, because then when I know more about it, I can challenge it and like ask, why are we not doing this? And why are we not trying to do this? Is this not possible to do? And sometimes it happens that we are then doing something that's
like
new
and
innovative. So probably more like a director of an artistic show, than just a chef. And I don't neglect to be a chef, because I think it's amazing craft. I love to eat in restaurants. It's more classical.
But you're also putting AI in it.
Yeah. Now there's AI in the experience as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. What do you think about sustainability? How do you link sustainability into food culture?
I mean, we try, much of the things that we're doing to express different certainties about different things, like we have our guilty pleasures, which is talking about the chocolate industry, that we crave way too much chocolate. We love chocolate. Everybody loves chocolate. And unfortunately, the production can't follow in that speed that we crave it. So it's compromising a lot of things, like working conditions, so child labor, deforestation, and there's a lot of problem with that industry, because it's so big. So how can you maybe how can we communicate that? Here we had this guilty pleasure, which is like a little chocolate bar, facts about the chocolate industry and the backside print up, and information come from UN to one of the world's most sustainable curated chocolates. And it's not to point any fingers, it's just to say that you need to, when you eat things and when you take it, you're making an active decision as well, so you need to think about it, to plastic in the oceans, which is a dish with like a cod jaw. Your addition, I think, was like a place fillet. And then it's with topped with edible plastic, and you need to consume the plastic like the fish do. Because there was a report from Danish Technology Institute, and 1/3 of all Danish cod was filled with microplastic inside. So we serve this edible plastic on top of that, and in that way convey a message
and talk about it.
Yeah, and I think that's been a very, in the start I was afraid of people would just say yeah it's fine and it tastes really good, and then but it's quite unbelievable like how many there's like every week crying when they hear like and it's more than one time a week that people cry and like it resonates with them. They wow. send me emails after that this changed the view on food, or from now on when they buy chickens they will only buy the organic ones because we have a chicken feed. Like so it seems like when people interact with it as they do and they need to digest it, it kind of resonates with them stronger maybe than seeing a documentary about it.
Of course, because you experience it yourself.
And I've been very surprised how much it actually moved guests. And in the start, I was like, they just saying it to be polite. But now it's so many people I have stories about this that say it changed them and changed the way that they're thinking about food in the future. And I think that's interesting when you look at...
That's important as well.
It's very important, yeah. And of course, this restaurant is very, what can you say, humble. And that was, it's 50 guests a night. We can maybe have 10,000 guests through the years that we will be open. So do we do an impact there? But then I think things and projects that we're doing, and that's also why it's important for me to do projects that's beyond the restaurant. So we're doing a charity for homeless in Copenhagen. We do Spora, our initiative for food technologies, and where we have just found a way to create rapeseed cake, which is the press when you do canola oil. We found a technology of creating that into human feed, which potentially can cover the protein need for 800 million people's lives. Oh. So if we can suddenly take some of the innovation and creativity that is in a restaurant like this and then scale it up to millions of people, then I think it makes sense to have a restaurant like that. Then
after I ate your food, and I was saying that why aren't you getting your 3 stars? Why is it only question. 2 stars? Then I was discussing with some friends, and my friends were saying that because. People don't understand the Michelin and the star. People won't understand what you're doing because you're touching too many senses. You're not focusing on food because they're very traditional. They just want to see food, not so many things going on. And it's very complicated. Do you agree with them? Because I think your food is really good.
No, thank you so much. I mean, these people ask me, like, why do you have 3 stars? And there's people who say, like your friends saying that it's because they are too traditional. I don't think so. I think they have embraced creativity through Michelin's history. Like El Bulli had 3 stars.
Yes,
Fat
I
Dog
went
had
to
3 stars and stuff like that. So I have 3 stars. So I think they have Noma have now 3 stars,
but
which are 2 stars for quite a long time.
Yeah,
so.
But El Bulli is very different because it's just about food.
I think there was element. I've never been to El Bulli, but I think there was element in it that was also maybe provocative in a way. Like maybe
it's,
not in the.
It's
it was
molecular.
Not making it on top,
at
yeah.
the time, you never have that, but it's food. Mm. But yours is not just taste of food or look. It's all that experience.
Yeah.
And I don't think any chef has used food as a social commentary.
No, not that we know of, and I think that's what's been unique. And maybe there is elements in that that's not resonating with the Michelin guy. I don't know. I also think it's a time thing. We were very privileged to get 2 stars directly in 19. That's the first restaurant in Denmark to do that. And to get the 1st star, I mean, it took, I think Noma took over, I don't know, 16 years or something. It was a long journey to get that. And
Noma took 16 years.
Yeah, they had only 2 stars, like for, I think they got the 3rd one here in 2008, was it 80, 90?
Like, really? So late?
20 or something, like 21
so
or something.
Late.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Noma,
it was under COVID, actually.
But but Noma was known to be the number one restaurant in the world.
So I think maybe they are more, I don't know, lean back in a way of saying, okay, we need to see, for these types of restaurants, there's maybe pushing the boundaries a little bit more than the traditional ones. Like maybe they need to see more time of consistency and so on before they give the 3 stars. It's an ambition I would love love to have it. I would love to have it for my guests, and because they ask me a lot, like, why don't you have the 3 stars? I'd love to have it for the team's sake, and personally also.
Do you feel is important?
I mean, it depends what perspective. Personally, yes, I would love to have it because it's what can you say? It's the Oscar.
It's a recognition.
It is Oscar of gastronomy, and when you use so many hours on this, and you really care about the cooking as well, and you think it's amazing yourself, and then our price level and so on, and our ambitions with what is invested in it. Of course, that on in a 3-star category ambition, there's 150 restaurants in the world that have 3 stars. So I would like to be one of them, and we compare ourselves with them normally on many other things. On the other hand, it's a gastronomical guide, which I think what we do here is more than just gastronomy.
Exactly.
And if there's something in the guide that's making it impossible for us to get because it have a criteria that you cannot dance with a performer, or you cannot get a dish where you don't like it, because that's also a part of it. We want to make sure that there's at least one dish in the night you maybe don't like, or maybe is a little bit out of your comfort zone. Otherwise, I don't think we succeed. And if that's one of the criteria, then we will probably never get it, and I will not change it for anything, because then I will accept that doesn't resonate with them. But I would love to have it, and I think we deserve it. And when they have the phrase they have for getting a 1-star is that it's worth traveling for. And if you look at our waiting list since we opened, to now over 1 million people from all around the world.
Oh my God, it's so difficult to book.
So I mean, that's I think that's proof that is at least for that criteria. So I hope one day that they will recognize the team and us for it. But I will not change anything to get that. And I think we could have done things that will be easier for ourselves. You know,
of course.
Serving more food that we were sure there was not anybody that will hate ingredients. We will not maybe not hang a pigeon in front of you. Remember not ask somebody to kiss with a silicone tongue and so on.
That's so funny.
Then
the
it will probably. Be I don't know,
so,
easier
so
to
funny.
Get it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And I never seen a restaurant with a mood board. Mood board.
A lot of mood boards. Yeah.
I mean, why would you? I mean, how do you think about using a mood board to create a restaurant?
I think a lot of times we in a situation where a lot of the things is in my head. I have a clear vision. I have a clear pictures of many things when I talk about a dish or when I talk about new content. I have in my imagination. I have exactly how this should. Supposed to look like what colors, what like, and I think a mood board and many times to show it, show different references and so on is a good way to work. Many of these here is for the industrial design team and the studio team as well.
Remus, you talk about when you were young, you were very, very enticed by the planetarium. Mm. So you create this dome like restaurant. Yeah. Was it difficult?
It was quite difficult. We got a lot of we got a couple of quotations from companies in the States was traveling around the world and doing these domes, but that was way too expensive. And I was like, we can probably do this ourselves. So visiting a lot of planetariums, especially the one in Copenhagen, took a lot of pictures of how that was done. And then we got my uncle, which is a blacksmith, to build this. But when we have done everything up and we put the first projector on, we could see that for some of the angles there was like gaps and shadows, and. Then I realized when I was thinking about it that in a planetarium you have kind of the same direction, you have the same viewing direction into the screen, and here in the restaurant you had 50 different views to it. So it was a long breath and try to navigate in what to do. We tried some different things with paintings and stuff like that to see if it was possible to not tear everything down again, but nothing really helped. And it's probably one of the decisions I'm most happy about have done today, because I could imagine myself being like sad with the result every day if I had to just kept on building. So we actually teared everything down, and we started all over again. It delayed the building time with 4 months.
So you delayed the whole opening?
Yeah. So when I sent the email, it was a Saturday evening. I remember it so clearly that we needed. I said to my uncle, "You need to drill all of it down again. And to put it in a context, there was 25,000 screws, like, or I don't know what you call them in English, but like when you pop into it, and they needed to go out again. There have been four guys doing that for nearly a month. And when I told him, he was literally like crying. He was so sad, and he was like, "I don't know if I can do it again." So we needed a little bit of got a good red wine and a good burger,
He was
up for it again. But we needed, actually, his two helpers didn't want to do it again, so we needed to find two other helpers to do it. But it was a night, because you need to drill everything down and then you need to put it up again.
Yeah.
And then we started to figuring out how to do this and don't
without
have
shadow.
Any. Gaps and shadows and so on, and I'm very happy I did, but it was also a very tough email to send.
Painful.
To my partner Lars, and also send it to all of the contractors, because they were ready to the day after that weekend to come in and do the flooring and everything, and set everything on hold. There was it was a tough one to do. Yeah.
What an experience.
Yeah,
bravo.
Thank you so much.
Very enlightening. Thank you, Remus. This is such a great, great session with you.